right, all right. Welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Opening the show up, I'm really, really pleased to be bringing you the final segment, the conclusion of the five-part interview that I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. And if people remember the last segment of the interview, I know a lot of people were like calling me, what did you do? Why did you leave off with that? I left off with posing a question to Bob Avakian and about do people have to be angels in order for this revolution to be, this revolution, this socialist society, this communist world to be realized. And he looked at it and he basically stopped and he said, no. And I stopped it there. And people were saying, well, I wanted to know what happened? Why not? Well, the reason is you're going to find out today, all right? And in this part of the interview, we come into this part off of the question that was posed last week, and that question being, do people have to be angels in order for such a revolution and socialist society to be realized? And Avakian answered it with a resounding no, and digging into this, he paints a picture of what his new synthesis of communism would look like in socialist society, the importance of things like a constitution, and then he talks about what it is that has kept him and continues to keep him on the revolutionary road after all these decades, all right? So without any further ado, this is Bob Avakian being interviewed by me, Michael Slate. So let's listen.
Now, I know what you sort of were, you know, implying here or you know, were suggesting is that many people say, well, what you're talking about sounds good, but it only work if people were angels, quote unquote. This is the old thing, if, you know, if it used to be said in the old days, if men were angels. You know, if people were angels, then okay, we wouldn't need, you know, the kind of society we have. But once again, we're back to, since people are not angels, they're basically selfish and out for self above all, etc., then we can't have the kind of society you're talking about. We have to have a society that corresponds to that. And lo and behold, guess what? It's the society we have now. So, you know, but then let's go directly to this question. Do people have to be, quote-unquote, perfect or angels in order for this revolution and its goal of first socialism and ultimately a communist world to actually be realized? No. In fact, that's one of the reasons why you need a constitution, because you are going to have the contradictions left over from the old society when you make a revolution, including the contradictions in the thinking of people, in the culture, in the ways that they're influenced, and so on, which you're going to have to struggle through at the same time and in connection with struggling through to transform further the economy, the social relations, the political structures, institutions and processes and so on. So that's why we've already, you know, even before the revolution has been made, we've brought forward a constitution for the new socialist republic in North America draft proposal in order to both lay out the vision and as concretely as we can of the actual ways in which that society would function and what would be its principles and, you know, and guidelines for how it should function in basic terms, while recognizing that there would be many particulars that we cannot anticipate now, and these principles would have to be applied in a creative way to those circumstances and might have to be adjusted in this or that particular, but while the core would be adhered to and carried forward. And we do go into this. This document is both very sweeping and also very concrete in a lot of ways, dealing with how the political system would function, how the economy would function, dealing with the realms of healthcare, education, science, the media, the armed forces, and so on and so forth. And I really strongly urge people to read and to seriously get into this Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America draft proposal and set it down next to and compare and contrast it with the present constitution we have of an exploitive and oppressive system which began on a foundation of slavery, among other things, and also to look into the constitutions of previous socialist countries to see how this one is different. This constitution for the new socialist republic in North America draft proposal is different in some ways from those previous socialist constitutions. If you want to actually see in important ways what this new synthesis of communism is all about, this constitution is an important way to begin digging into that, both in terms of the different particular aspects of social life and transformation, but also in terms of philosophy and method and also in terms of the fundamental internationalism that informs this constitution and the new synthesis that it's an expression of, and the whole basic orientation that the goal is the emancipation of humanity as a whole. So once again, I really urge people to really dig into this. I would like to see this a course taught comparing and contrasting these different constitutions in colleges, but also in high schools. And I think it's something that students could actually, contrary to the way in which they're slandered and the way in which sometimes it appears they're not interested in big things, I think they could really get into this in a big way. So I just put that plug in for
that. That's great. Actually, that would be tremendous.
I think that could actually be very, you know, to be serious, I think it could be a really good thing.
Yeah.
And help develop people's sense of a possibility, you know, break the sense of the permanent necessity of existing conditions, and also give people a concrete sense of a radical alternative as well as a sweeping sense of that, and also develop their ability to think critically in comparing and contrasting these things. So why do you have a constitution? You have a constitution in effect, and to put it very simply, sets down the basic rules and principles on which society should function and will function. And precisely the purpose of a constitution like this is to address the fact that you're not dealing with perfect human beings, and you're not dealing with angels. You're not dealing with people as they would be in the future, after society and the people who make up society have gone through further transformation in the socialist period and carrying forward the revolution further in that new situation. You're dealing with people who have undergone many important changes in coming to the recognition and the consciousness that they need a revolution and that they need to fight together with other people for that revolution. But you're also dealing with people who are still significantly, to use a somewhat crude phrase, stamped with the influence of the society out of which they've come and you know through which they've emerged to this new society. So a constitution sets down rules and principles in which people can relate in a different way, in which the economy and the social relations and the political system can be developed in a radically different way, but also in which the rights of the people are delineated and clear and set down, and the principles guiding those rights are made clear, and a standard is provided to which people should adhere, and to which people, in a real sense, will be held in terms of what their relations with other people can and cannot be. That you can't, you know, for example, you'll have laws that are passed based on this Constitution by the legislative bodies that the Constitution provides for to be set up through the functioning of this society in accordance with this Constitution. You have laws which will protect people's rights, but will also prevent people from doing certain things. You can't go into your neighbor's house and you know, shoot your neighbor and take their property. You can't go out and assault women. You can't rape women. You can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or on the basis of nationalities. So it'll both set forward standards for people to aspire to, but it will also indicate the standards of what the society insists are ways in which people should relate to each other, but also ways in which they can't relate to each other, in ways that are oppressive and exploitative, while at the same time, and this is an important part of the new synthesis of communism, allowing for, and not only allowing for, but fostering and creating an atmosphere in which dissent will play an important part in society, and an atmosphere in which there will be encouraging of dissent, in which dissent, including from the policies of the party and the policies of the government, which dissent, even of that kind, can actually be encouraged and flourish. So all that is also part of what's stressed in this Constitution, both in talking about the rights of the people, but also in terms of talking about the educational system in this socialist society, and the priority it puts on promoting what it calls a spirit of scientific curiosity and critical thinking. And a whole way in which it addresses the question of art and culture, including the support to some art and culture which is directly oppositional to what is the prevailing policy at a given time of the government, what is, you know, what the party might be arguing and struggling for within the society at a given time. And art and also provides for people to develop art and culture, you know, would be the equivalent of garage bands and things like that, people doing on their own initiative even without government funding, and the ability of them to go out and raise funds for that art and culture so long as they don't use it for the actual production and promotion of that art and culture and not to set up businesses on the side to exploit other people. So one of the purposes of having a constitution is you recognize that you have people as they've come out of the old society, even though they've gone through big changes to get to the point where they are seeing the need for and willing to fight and sacrifice and to unite with other people and overcome the kind of petty rivalries that are so much of daily life in this society in order to unite with people to make a revolution, you're still dealing with people that have come out of the old society. And let's face it, when everybody gets to the high point of struggling for something, a lot of petty differences get put to the side and overcome. But then when the struggle subsides, a lot of them reassert themselves. And this will happen even after you've had a whole big revolutionary change. So you have a constitution and you have guidelines and principles, both in that constitution and in terms of the approach of the party, which is still has the responsibility of leading all this, to recognize that and to carry forward the struggle to further transform the culture and people's ways of thinking, together with transforming the economy, the social relations, the political system, the political structures and institutions, and so on, and the relations internationally, all aiming toward a radically different world where you won't have angels. But you'll have the absence of oppressive and antagonistic relations among people, and people in different parts of the world will not be at loggerheads with each other, divided up into separate nations and countries. And differences will still exist and still be struggled out, and maybe there'll even be a few, you know, people who have mental illnesses, other things, who will do things that are detrimental to society. But you won't need a state, a dictatorship, to actually enforce the interests of the prevailing system. These things can be handled through the mutual interaction of people on an increasingly conscious and voluntary basis. And even problems like people who have mental problems will be dealt with in a radically different way without having to have a whole system of police and jails and so on to deal with it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is part five of the five-part interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. In this segment, Avakian talks about why people don't have to be perfect in order for revolution, socialism, and communism to work, okay? If you missed any part of this interview, any one of the segments that we ran earlier, you can access them by going to the KPFK archives or by going to revcom.us. That's revcom.us. Which brings me to this point, dictatorship. Because even as you say all this, this does involve the dictatorship of the proletariat. That's an important part of the new synthesis, right?
Yes, and this is also embodied in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic. There are ways in which that Constitution and the new synthesis in general envisions this dictatorship being exercised differently than in some ways than in the past socialist societies in their experience. But, you know, look, a dictatorship doesn't mean you have a few people ordering everybody around. That's why one of the reasons why we have a constitution. People's, you know, the procedures and the processes and institutions of the governance of society are spelled out there, including the way in which elections will play a role in that through various forms. And the whole point is that you need a government and a state, including, yes, security forces and armed forces, both to protect your revolution, but also, you know, from foreign enemies and from internal forces who will actually try to violently overthrow it and sabotage it violently and so on. But also, you need a state to back people up who've been the formerly oppressed and exploited people, but who are now coming to the forefront, whether it's people who've been discriminated against in the old society in various ways, or, you know, people who've been bitterly exploited under the old system, or women whose oppression has been one of the foundation stones of the whole system and has been bound up with the division of society into exploiters and exploited since that first emerged in human history thousands of years ago. These forces need backing from the state in order to be able to, in a certain sense, go uphill to fight to continue to transform and eliminate the remaining elements of the old oppressive relations and traditions and the ways of thinking that go along with it. So when we talk about a dictatorship, we're talking about a state which serves those classes and groups in society who are striving to further transform society toward the abolition of all these old traditions and relations that oppress and exploit people. And we're talking about a state which protects the rights of people, such as what I was referring to earlier, that, you know, you work. You know, the idea of socialism and communism is not, by the way, everybody will have the same toothbrush or, you know, be like birds. You know, everybody will eat the same food. Some people will eat it and regurgitate it, and then other people eat it. That's not the whole point.
I'm going to make sure I'm in the right place in line, okay?
That is not what is meant by communism. Communism and socialism, moving toward communism, means the common ownership through the state, but increasingly by all of society, of the means of production and resources of creating wealth in society, the land, the factories, the machinery, the technology, and so on. And the marshaling and utilization of that according to a plan drawn up by drawing on the thinking of the people and then systematizing and concentrating it to actually utilize and marshal the resources of society in a planned way to meet the needs of the people both materially and also intellectually and culturally, to put away store for the future and for natural disasters, to defend the revolution, and also to support the revolution in the world as a whole while the revolution is being backed and supported in its further continuation within the socialist country itself. That's the whole point of a socialist state. And that's the whole point of what we mean by the common ownership by the people of the means of production and resources of society. Not that all the consumer items and items of personal consumption that people have will be owned by everybody and there'd be this horrible situation of everybody having to use everybody's toothbrush or something like that. But there is a fact that there will still be personal items. And there will still be, because of the influences of the old society, both ideologically and also the remaining inequalities that I've spoken about, there will still be a need to protect people's rights, including their right to their personal items of consumption, from encroachment by other people who might try to wrongfully take it away, even if that's not a major social phenomenon. So you need a state for all those reasons. And when you say a dictatorship, what you're reflecting is the fact that so long as you have society divided into different classes and social groups, then the state is going to reflect the interests of the economically dominant class, the class that dominates in terms of its ownership of the major means of production and resources of society. In capitalism, that's the capitalist class, or to use the French word, the bourgeoisie, and so you have a capitalist or a bourgeois dictatorship. In socialist society, it's the formerly exploited class of working people, the proletariat, and the broad masses of people who have now become the people who are now determining the direction of society. And they are utilizing the state to back up their struggle to carry forward that revolution and to prevent the principles and laws that are in the Constitution and flow from the Constitution from being violated in ways that would undermine the further transformation of that society and the support for the world revolution. And the goal, unlike all previous societies, is not just to get a stronger and stronger state. It's to move together with the revolutionary struggle throughout the world to where you've overcome all these different class divisions, oppressive relations and inequalities, and the ways of thinking and culture that go along with them, so that you no longer have antagonistic divisions or oppressive divisions among any part of humanity anywhere in the world. And therefore you no longer need, and you no longer should have and will not have, a state to back up the rule of one part of society over another, even if that one part, as in socialism, represents the interests of the great majority of society and is moving in the direction of eliminating any oppressive divisions between people in society. Now, until you get to that point, you need a state to help and to back up, not only to defend the revolution, but to help and back up the struggle toward that. But you also should have, and the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, draft proposal, says very clearly that one of the clear principles of the state and of the party which is leading the state is not only to continuously propagate the goal of moving toward all that, moving toward the elimination of all these divisions, and therefore moving beyond the need for any kind of a state or any kind of a dictatorship, but to actually carry forward transformations in society that more and more involve people in the governance of society, in determining the affairs of state, and moving in the direction where the state can eventually, as Marx put it, wither away, together with the withering away, or the overcoming, I should say, more actively overcoming, of the remaining vestiges, if you will, of the old oppressive relations and inequalities. So the point being, if you don't have a state to defend your revolution and to back up people carrying forward that revolution and along with that to actually protect the rights of the people in that society, then you're going to get forces who are going to move to and succeed in overthrowing your revolution, and all the struggle and sacrifice that has gone into making that revolution is not only going to be wasted, but it's going to be drowned in blood. And then it won't just be ideological revenge that'll be taken. There'll be very practical and murderous revenge taken on the people who made that revolution, particularly on the people at the very bottom of society who finally were able to break through, raise their heads, and lead others to fight all the way through. They are going to be subjected to the most merciless revenge on the part of the people who fought to and were defeated initially to maintain the old society, but have now come back and are determined that never again will people even dare to think about rising up in this way.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is part five of the five-part interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. In this segment, Avakian talks about why people don't have to be perfect in order for revolution, socialism, and communism to work, okay? If you missed any part of this interview, any one of the segments that we ran earlier, you can access them by going to the KPFK archives or by going to revcom.us. That's revcom.us.
Let me ask you this. This will be the last one on this section, and then we'll wrap the interview up. But I wanted to ask you this. How do you keep people from settling in? How do you keep people from saying, look, we got it pretty damn good now, and in a weird way, a kind of very weird reassertion of permanent necessity of existing conditions? How do you keep that from happening?
Well, I think it's a combination of different things. One, there's a need for continual, this is one of the reasons why you need continual leadership, to continually raise people and struggle to raise people's sights to the larger goal, that we can't stop the revolution halfway, because then if we do, it'll be reversed. I mean, I've used the example of, you know, of rock climbing. You know, I've read about people, I've never done this, but I've read about people in, you know, in Yosemite and places, you know, who go up these steep, some of them even without safety ropes, which I think is, want to talk about something crazy. I think that's absolutely insane, but they do it, you know. But in leaving that aside, the particularity of without safety ropes, you know, it's, I've read about, you know, these rock climbing up these steep cliffs and how, you know, you get to a certain ledge and you can sort of, you know, you are confronted with how do you reach, and not only reach sometimes, but actually make a leap to grab a new handhold in order to keep going up. And if you try to just stay where you are, eventually you're going to wear out and you're probably going to fall. So to use that as a metaphor, it's a somewhat tortured metaphor, but I think it has, you know, it has some purpose here, some usefulness here. You know, it's kind of like making a revolution, even after you've taken the first great leap and overthrown the old system and established the new, you have to continue the revolution up this steep precipice. And you have to keep making leaps and grabbing new footholds, which is, you know, people become reluctant to do because it means taking further risks and risking giving up what you've gained so far. But if you don't, as with the rock climbing, to once again slightly torture the metaphor, you can fall all the way back down. And furthermore, to further embellish and perhaps, you know, further torture the metaphor, you know, you're doing this not in perfect weather. It's often storming, because that being, you know, equivalent to the attacks from the enemies of the revolution, both within the society, but also from countries around the world who don't want to see the example and the force of this revolution spread. So you will have a constant tendency, the point of all this, you'll have a constant tendency to settle in, you know, and to say, we've made great changes, life is much better, so why don't we just stop here, even though there are remaining oppressive relations. One of the main ways that that will take form and find expression is around the relation between men and women and the status of women. That there'll be a tendency to say, let's not go further with that because it's going to disturb a lot of things in the family and a lot of personal relations, and it's going to disturb the unity that's been forged, so let's just stop it. Which, if you do that, it means that women are going to still be held by the various chains of oppression that have held them down for thousands of years, and things are going to be propelled in the direction of going backward in regard to that, as well as in a more overall sense. But there's also a positive side to this picture, which is, in addition to a leadership which constantly is struggling to raise people's sights to the need to continue the revolution and to support it in the world as a whole, because if you don't make this revolution in the world as a whole, and the whole world is not being transformed toward the emancipation of humanity, then you're going to be pushed back anywhere that you've initially broken through and established a socialist state. So you got to go forward toward the final goal. So you need a leadership that's constantly struggling to raise people's sights to that, through the, you know, what it does in the realm of culture as well as in politics and so on. But in addition, that leadership, it's very important for that leadership to also be able to identify what are the contradictions in society that are kind of acute concentrations of the need to continue the revolution, of a need to continue transforming society. I mentioned the status of women. This will be one of the things in socialist society that will most concentrate the need to continue the revolution and will bring forward forces who need to be fostered and supported, who want to fight to make sure this revolution doesn't stop halfway and leave women still in a chained position or an inferior and subordinated position, even if it's improved over the horrors of what it was in the old society. And there will be other forces in society that will come forward around some of the remaining contradictions, which are still elements and still concentrate elements of the old existing within the new that need to be overcome and transformed. And it's the role of leadership to continue recognizing and fostering and giving support and leadership to these forces who want to fight around these contradictions that can propel the revolution forward, including in relation to the whole international dimension. But there's no magic solution to any of these things. There's no magic wand that you can wave. There's no formula you can set down on things and say, if you just apply this, everything's going to go. This is a matter of struggle. It's a living process all the way through from now all the way to the goal of communism. And then there'll be a living process of people transforming society in communism, you know, when there are no longer antagonistic relations among people, but there's still contradictions among people and in terms of their relations with the rest of nature and in the thinking of the people and so on. It's just that it won't be embedded in a whole system and dynamics of oppression and exploitation and antagonism among people. So, you know, you need this kind of leadership to get there, but there is, you know, the leadership has to be constantly regrounding itself in and further developing and implying in a creative way the scientific outlook and method that's needed for this. And, you know, that you're going to make mistakes. You have to learn from your mistakes. You know, there's no great, if you pardon the expression, enterprise or, in better said, maybe endeavor by human beings. Certainly any kind that attempts to solve any big problems that isn't going to go off course at times and make mistakes. This is all part of the process. You have to be able to recognize where you've gone off course or made mistakes and struggle to get back on course and learn from the whole process. And it's a living process, you know, that is the point from Goethe about, you know, the tree of life is green. Theory is very important, but real life will be much more, you know, rich and more complex than that. And you have to keep on learning and struggling. And the way that you have the possibility, and it's just a possibility, it's not a guarantee, but it's a real possibility of actually going forward with this and learning from mistakes and setbacks and going forward again, till you reach the goal of communism ultimately. The way you have that is both the orientation of continually fighting to keep that larger goal in mind and evaluating everything in terms of how it relates to that larger goal, and at the same time the scientific outlook and method of communism, not as a dry and once and for all finished dogma, but as a living science that has to be applied. And, you know, an ongoing process of theory and practice and back to theory and learning from reality as you're changing reality.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and this is part 5 of the 5-part interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a little while ago. In this segment, Avakian talks about why people don't have to be perfect in order for revolution, socialism, and communism to work, okay? If you missed any part of this interview, any one of the segments that we ran earlier, you can access them by going to the KPFK archives or by going to revcom.us. That's revcom.us.
I have to ask you this. Is that what keeps you going? I mean, I was telling you earlier, when you talked about, and this really struck me, and I don't know why it struck me so heavily, because I've seen it before, but the points that you've made and you were continuing to make tonight about communism is not inevitable, that this isn't something that's just going to, it was destined to happen, but that it's the way things came together. And then there's the conscious working on this. And you, above all, I mean, I think that the point that, literally, if people haven't had a chance to see your revolution talk or to have listened to your, you know, your conversations with people, you know, this point, you vibrate with a boundless enthusiasm for communism, for revolution, for communism, for the emancipation of humanity. You really do vibrate with that. It's almost like every fiber is sort of like on fire around, we've got to get here. And I really wanted to ask you, and I know this is sort of it's at the end of this very intense wrestling with a lot of questions, but I really wanted to ask you, and for you to give people a sense of, what is it that keeps you on that road, that keeps you from settling in?
Well, I think there are, the best that I can answer that, I think there are two main things. One is, at a certain point in my life, I came to see the world, you know, in basic terms, the way it is, and the terrible way in which the majority of humanity is suffering. And more than that, the fact that we arrive at the point where this is completely needless. And, you know, it's one thing for suffering to be horrific, but when it's totally unnecessary, it becomes all the more intolerable. And I've never lost my sense of that. And I continually go back to that. And, you know, that the revolution we're talking about and the struggle for communism is not just some sort of personal endeavor. It's not about people being able to finally reach their own personal aspirations or overcome their personal frustrations, you know, or even to just realize a personal vision. It's about the condition and the possibilities for the masses of people in the world and ultimately for humanity as a whole. And the fact that on the other side of that, if we don't make this revolution, if we don't advance to communism, if you look what people are put through, if you look what's happening with the environment, if you look at the wars and the arsenals that are waged and maintained by these imperialist powers, you can see that life is going to continue to be a horror if there even is a future after a certain point for humanity. So you constantly come back to the fact that this revolution is necessary, but also that it's possible. And that kind of interacts with the very crucial point of science, in particular the science of communism, because you can lose that sense even if you have, you know, really deeply grounded sensibilities and feelings around that, around the condition of humanity and the fact that this needs to be radically changed. You can lose your bearings and have that sense dulled if you don't continually apply the science, you know, a scientific approach and method, and in specifically the science of communism, to continue in probing and investigating, learning about and summing up what you're learning and identifying the patterns that you're seeing in reality. And in the way in which this enables you to get more and more deeply grounded in an understanding that, in fact, not only is the world intolerable and will remain that way for the great majority of humanity if we don't have a revolution and we don't break through and eventually get to communism in the world as a whole, but that this is actually not the only way the world could be, that there is actually a basis within the way the world has actually developed and within the contradictory character of the reality that we're up against and the pathways that that opens or the possibilities of struggle that can be forced out of that to actually get to communism. And when you combine the basic orientation that I spoke of not turning away from, but constantly confronting and being grounded in a basic sense in the reality of what this world and this system means for the great majority of humanity up against the potential of a much better way the world could be. And the fact that this is not the only possible way, that there is no permanent necessity to these conditions, that we could have a radically different and much better world. That orientation, sort of interacting with and being mutually reinforced by and with the science of communism and its application in the way I've been speaking of, is what gives you the basis to keep going forward. And the more that you have that, the more that you are fired, in fact, with a drive and an enthusiasm, yes, to fight for that and to do everything you can to contribute to it.
Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a man whose vision and work has opened up a door to a whole new world and who is leading the fight to get there. Thank you very much for doing this interview and for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
All right, that was an interview I did with Bob Avakian, the chairman of the RCP, and that was the fifth and final segment of that interview. And if you've missed any, and if you were inspired off of this, let me put it that way, if you were inspired off this, if you wanted to dig into more about what he's talking about, you know, if you sat back and thought, wait a minute, it's true. It is possible. We don't have to live like this. It is possible to be living a whole different way. If that's the situation, make sure you get access to this interview. You can either access all of the individual segments here at kpfk.org, at the archives at kpfk.org, or you can go to revcom.us and access all of them right there and learn a whole lot more about the entire movement for revolution that Avakian is leading.